Hi, it's Danielle Radoichin, and this is In Talks With, a series of bite-sized chats about culture from lockdown and beyond.
Hi, Michael Salu. How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
We are speaking to each other over the internet on the 10th of July, 2020. Mm-hmm. I'm in London and you're in Berlin, which is your home. How are things?
Things are, let's say, interesting, because Berlin has come back to life, but in quite a different way. The first notable thing is it doesn't have this sort of constant flow of tourism that it would usually have. So the city is even more sort of spare somehow. But Berliners seem to be trying to get back to normal life. Certainly a lot of socializing. Bars are open, restaurants are open. But I'm also aware that there's a lot of businesses that rely on tourism. So I think there's a lot that's actually in flux right now. I'm sort of very conscious that a lot of people are still struggling. A lot of artists based here whose work might have been more international haven't been able to do so. So there's a new version of Berlin that seems to be appearing, and I don't yet know what it is. I mean, my own experience of it is also kind of odd, because obviously I've been at home like everyone else for a long period of time, and psychologically I don't yet feel particularly comfortable or ready to. I don't think it's so much about the sort of the invisible threat of the virus that's there. It's more such an extended period of isolation has been quite significant, at least for me. And there's a huge part of me that found that quite interesting. And I wasn't sure if I was quite ready to relinquish that yet. So something else is happening within myself. And I don't yet know if I want to go immediately back into the old world, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. And I have felt something similar, a sort of reluctance to get sort of tugged back into what was quite a sort of frenetic pace previously. Mm. I've also, that was interesting just to your point about the lack of tourists making everything feel so quiet. I was in Notting Hill the other day and with a friend, and it's also somewhere, we were on Portobello Road, which is obviously usually full of tourists, and it was really quiet for the same reasons. And my friend just said, oh, it just feels like it's local again. And I thought, oh yeah, that is really nice. But then I thought, actually, it is nice, but then it's becoming something else. And it is obviously, that's a problem for people whose businesses rely on tourism and that kind of thing. But it is, what's interesting is this sort of local, things are becoming local again because people are living in a local way again. Mm. But because of the internet, everyone's able to have a global voice and a global perspective and see what's happening in a very this massive way. So that's quite an interesting sort of tension. You are a creative strategist, an artist, a writer, and a founder of House of Thought, which is a digital consultancy. Mm-hmm. You've done many interesting things. You've written for literary journals and you lecture at universities about this overlapping of technology, language, and identity. Can you just expand a bit on what that involves?
Absolutely. Well, I've been sort of more recently interested in the way language has evolved as a result of use of technology. And through that, I just sort of noticed a kind of shift in terms of how we understand ourselves, in terms of how we communicate. And I felt, or at least I've been studying the space, the way I think that language itself has developed a certain kind of autonomy beyond our sort of management of language. In the way that we're talking about kind of intersexual identity, the way we talk about race, the way we talk about all these different aspects, I've been sort of exploring how do I explain this? It's a little bit complicated, but I've been exploring how language is a sort of vehicle in its own right, beyond our own use of it, if that makes sense. And I've recently just finished writing a book, which is currently in the system, so hopefully it'll be visible soon. And through that book, what I try to do is sort of stitch
together. Sorry, is that We Do God's Work?
Yes, it is. And it's a collection of, you would call it a collection of short stories in its most, if you were sort of be talking about it in a rather straightforward manner. But what those stories are actually doing are operating as individual sort of critical essays, as finding different ways to talk about culture and society as it's being shifted and reimagined through technology. So I look at the way that we view sexuality, I look at the way we view gender and race and how those things overlap. And how they overlap in a way that isn't necessarily part of the current discourses that we're having. And I think I was really interested to bring to light, because I think it's very easy to sort of like create categories around very specific aspects of identity. And I also find that quite problematic, because as we know, life isn't as rigid as that. But what we have in the digital space is that's a much easier way to manage and structure information. So I've been interested in the humanity beyond the information. So we're entering this kind of post-human space in a way because of the nature of the way that we're communicating. And I think this has also been accelerated by COVID as well. So how does this post-human space be able to maintain a kind of the fluidity of humanity without us just sort of living in categories? So that's what I've been trying to tackle for the book.
And what sort of conclusions, have you come to?
The book has no conclusion because I typically wrote it that way, partly because it's fiction. But what I was sort of trying to do is at least just address a particular way, or a slightly different way of looking at now, as opposed to trying to sort of draw any strong conclusion. So I hope through the way that I use language, through the way that I've structured these stories, that they offer a different, slightly different perspective, particularly on sort of black identity, contemporary black identity, because it isn't as uniform and as singular as part of the current discourse around it is being led. And I'm very sort of keen to sort of rip the lid off that and sort of show how multifaceted that space is, but also how difficult the actual conversations are around race. And I think the intersection of race and technology is a very interesting and also deeply problematic environment, particularly with things like bias within machine learning and artificial intelligence and so on. So I've been sort of tackling some of that within the book too.
You grew up in London. I know that you spent time in Nigeria as well. Mm. Was it Lagos? I wasn't sure.
Yes,
it was Lagos.
Yes.
I said Nigeria in a very general way. So you grew up in London, but you spent time in Lagos. I believe your parents are from Nigeria. But I know that the bulk of your childhood and upbringing was in London. And you moved to Berlin a few years ago. Does Berlin, do you feel what you've been talking about with regard to those themes, the sort of your new way of looking at race and how it overlaps with these different areas such as technology, do you find that Berlin complements this sort of your way of thinking in a particular way? I mean, is that part of the reason that you decided to live there?
Yes, I wouldn't say. I think Berlin offers another part to this, to my narrative in a sense, partly because I think it really reflects the way that I grew up. So the way that I grew up was very much driven by influences from all over the place, particularly in music and literature. So, you know, I grew up with a deep love of Russian literature. And as I got older, I had a particular interest in 20th century history, European history, and also electronic music and all these sort of things. So Berlin has kind of been a safe haven in that respect. But what I wouldn't say it necessarily determines my identity. I think what I found interesting about it, because I've been coming here for quite a long time, since 2006. So what I always found interesting about it is that Berlin offers this international cross-section of ideas. In that respect, it's quite a hub. And I always said it was, I think Berlin is sort of, will be like the last bastion of sort of common sense. I think a lot of people come here and find themselves immediately fitting with the identity of the city. So the city has a certain kind of way of existing, which has been built up, particularly across the 20th century and even prior to that, that sustains a certain kind of rebellious, more socialist kind of perspective. So even through its gentrification, even through its development, there's still a sense of prioritizing individuals and communities and self-expression. So that obviously I've been quite drawn to. I developed my entire career in London. That was my home, and I didn't think I would leave.
You had an amazing career. You were at Granta for many years.
I did. Yeah.
So you were the creative director there.
Yes, it's a wonderful company. And prior to that, I worked at Penguin Random House as well. So I think my reasons for moving to Berlin were quite personal. They weren't so specifically economic. It was more that, obviously I'm very sensitive to the political landscape in the United Kingdom. This is where I'm from. This is my home. And I started to find it quite problematic. And I think I was a bit of an early adopter, paying attention to a lot of the kind of hostile policies that were starting to, or at least the rhetoric that was starting to come through from the British Home Office and so on.
What are you referring to specifically?
So I'm sort of talking about, I think over the last decade or so, the Conservative government have been installing increasingly more hostile policy and rhetoric around immigration. And when I started to see that manifest in the UK around, say, 2014 or so, I think my concern was that what was happening already was trying to destabilize multiple generations of immigrants in the United Kingdom, which kind of sort of took me aback a little bit. So there were very early signs of that, and I think, you know, it's really noticeable as to what's happening now. And I wasn't saying that I necessarily wanted to leave the United Kingdom forever, but I certainly didn't want to be around and watch this, because I feel like I'm quite sensitive to what that actually really means. Does that make sense?
Yeah, was Brexit feeding into that decision as well?
I moved prior to Brexit, but yes, that was also part of it too. I still don't know what that entirely means for us.
but, it's sort of been, it's sort of taken a back seat weirdly, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I noticed that you posted some images on your Instagram feed from some protests. That were related to the Black Lives Matter protest movement. I assume that means that you were on the marches, or a march. Can you just describe a bit about what that experience was like?
I actually attended more just to bear witness. I think contextually it doesn't really, I don't know if I really fit into what was happening there. In some respects, it was quite strange, but it was also quite sort of heartwarming to see there was something like approximately 15,000 plus people in that particular area that we were. For me, it was more the sort of documenting the experience of being exposed to this, to see in this moment, because the moment took on a certain amount of significance in a way that maybe is not going to be so easily erased. And I think the way that process works, obviously, it takes time for it to kind of reach policy level. It takes time for it to reach the level of change, and usually a number of years. But then I just wanted to witness that kind of momentum and see that shift happen. Because, you know, for myself as an individual, it's a strange experience to be, like, it's a strange sensory experience to be exposed to that, because there are people, many people like myself, who've never essentially waited to have their identity be validated. So there's a little bit of a tension there between that of myself as an individual who has always applied himself in whichever ways he's needed to, and acutely conscious of all the difficulties and all the kind of problems that are within our society and grapple with them, but has never sort of waited for anyone else to validate that, you know, my existence or that, you know. So I found the tension of those two things quite interesting. So having been surrounded by, you know, majority white Germans sort of shouting Black Lives Matter was a quite a surreal thing, but I also wanted to just kind of be there and document it, because I realized that there's a younger generation coming through that are very vehement and very passionate about this and beginning to sort of strategize around this and actually, you know, paying attention to history and, you know, and educating themselves in the right way. And I think that that's been quite inspiring. And I think that's really noticeable in London as well. And it was equally noticeable how quick there were certain sort of media outlets doing their best to demonize that energy, whereas that energy is actually really genuine. So I'm very curious to see where it goes.
Just a couple more questions. One thing you mentioned, that it's a very a younger generation coming through. I don't know if you were aware about this letter that was signed in Harper's Magazine earlier this week by sort of very prolific writers. Yes. Like Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood, Malcolm Gladwell. That just sort of has, you know, there's been some discussion around that about how it's a, you know, they might not understand because they're part of an older generation or an older way of thinking. And I just wondered if you had thought about that, and if you do think that, is it really a mindset that's to do with this new generation? Is it really that this an older generation just can't understand it?
I mean, the Harper's letter is an odd thing. It's like, you know, in some ways I didn't quite understand it, because there feels like there's a bit of a disconnect occurring between what is a space for imagination and reflection and what is this idea of, like, you know, free speech. I think that they're two different areas. I don't think there is actually part of the same conversation. I think we're conflating that. And I think the real conversation is about agency. So what has allowed certain authors to reach the point in which they've got to get, you know, to have that platform to be able to speak? That is actually the real issue here. It's the imbalance of agency, the imbalance of access, which I think, you know, publishing as an industry is actually dealing with at the moment. So what people are saying, certainly the younger generation, is that actually, if I had the opportunity to go to Oxford and I had access to this, you know, creative writing master's degree that didn't destroy me from, you know, financially for the next 10 years, then maybe I might be able to say what you're saying or offer an argument that is different to yours, but is appreciated and accessed on the same level as yours, so we can have a discourse. But you cannot use the hierarchy to make that suggestion of, you know, who gets to say what. That doesn't actually quite add up, because there isn't parity there. And obviously I worked in an industry, I worked in publishing for a number of years, and I could count the number of non-white faces in the company. And that's just the nature of it. And I think that's what that conversation is really about. It's about having access. And then, you know, so in some respects, the internet has democratized that access. So people are able to build their own platforms and have their own voices. And this, in a way, this kind of hegemonic structure of whose voice is validated and which literature is regarded we need to have a new conversation about that, I think.
That's so interesting. Just before we finish, you're so prolific and doing so much work in different areas. Has this moment of being inside or at home more, has that inspired you to do anything else new or differently?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because it's been a very deep moment of deep reflection for myself. So what it had done, I was asking myself, what do I really want to do? Like, which aspect of my work do I really, really love and want to prioritize? Like, what has the most meaning for me? And you can look at it, you know, existentially, like how long do I have on this planet? So therefore, what do I want to focus my energy on? So I would then start having conversations about, you know, thinking of, like, between money and expression and the kind of intellectual development, which is partly why I set up House of Thought, because I thought there's a way of marrying those two areas of my work, one that's more commercially driven, but one that's more research and ideas driven. So all this has done is sort of crystallized that energy and said to myself that I really want to sort of focus on just producing the work that inspires me and just continuing to sort of develop intellectually in a way that I find most rewarding. So I'm developing a couple of like art projects at the moment around this kind of area of like post-humanity. And, you know, so I'm working, bringing literature together with like machine learning and experimenting with that. And I'm also writing a second book. So it's just galvanized my desire to kind of, you know, really sort of engage with the world as much as possible.
Cool. Thank you. I'll look out for that. Thank you for speaking to me today. I've really enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
You've been listening to In Talks with me, Danielle Radoichin. The sound and theme music were by Wargie Productions, and the artwork is by Patrick Waugh. If you enjoyed this episode, please pass it on to someone who you think might also like it. And of course, please do subscribe and leave a review. Thanks for listening.